Well, Michigan's Betsy DeVos reportedly under consideration by the Trump administration as a potential Secretary of Education, according to several reports. There are these reports have appeared in The Hill, The Washington Post, and Politico, amongst others. There are a handful of candidates, according to these stories. Ms. DeVos is a charter school and voucher advocate, the spouse, of course, of billionaire conservative Dick DeVos. Jonathan Osting of the Detroit News writes about it in today's Detroit News as well. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. 13th is a documentary film and a Netflix original directed by Ava DuVernay. DuVernay's been best known for directing Selma, the story of Martin Luther King's historic 1965 civil rights march. 13th has a lot of familiar names and faces in it, and one of them is from Michigan. Current State's Brooke Allen is here to tell us who that is and what 13th is all about. Hi, Brooke.
Hey, good morning, Mark. Well, 13th, of course, refers to the 13th Amendment, which outlawed slavery unless it's been used as a punishment for a crime. And former Michigan House Speaker Craig DeRoche is actually in the documentary. Mr. DeRoche is now the Senior Vice President of Advocacy and Public Policy for Prison Fellowship, and it's no surprise he was asked to be in the film. 13th touches on many issues involving the criminal justice system, starting with slavery, moving on through the civil rights movement, the war on drugs, and the increase in mass incarceration. And Craig DeRoche says there is a reason 13th was the first documentary ever chosen to open the New York Film Festival.
It's a wonderful film, and I think it's a wonderful place to start because it, to me, the 13th Amendment addressing the involuntary servitude, you know, is the first way it's stated. And then the second way it stated is slavery, which I think is because of the time and the issues that were before the Congress and in the 13th Amendment that they wanted to make it stated in plain English. But without the courts being able to force somebody to pay back the damage they've done, we would be at a great disadvantage. You know, that if somebody stole a laptop out of my car and the courts couldn't tell the person they had to pay me back the damage of the laptop, their only recourse would be to incarcerate the person. They wouldn't be able to enforce anything. So it's a complicated issue. It was a choice of words that President Abraham Lincoln and the Congress chose, and I think that the problems of what started with people trying to find workarounds for the changes in our country that were led so brilliantly by our greatest president, Abraham Lincoln, it began immediately that yes, we no longer have slavery, but how do we work around this? And it's continued to this day. And the criminal justice system has been a lever for those that want to repel certain races or ethnicities or religions from their community, from their region, from institutions like schools, and I think it was a creative choice that Ava DuVernay made, and it made the point well. But I would also put up an asterisk and say that well-intentioned people, and including places like Detroit, Michigan, that have largely been governed by African American leadership, have behaved the same way as folks in cities with predominantly Caucasian leadership. And so I would say that we need to continue to work at the structural problems that we have that has led to the human behavior of our police force and our prosecutors and our judges enforcing the law in a way that's inconsistent with our values, regardless of their race, too.
And how you felt about being in this documentary, I mean, this is, you know, even last week before, I've never mentioned that I was going to interview you, never mentioned I was going to watch this documentary, and just randomly I would see people post about this on my Facebook feed.
Yeah, it was a great honor to be asked by Ava DuVernay and the entire team. It's an incredible commitment that Netflix made in investing in this and letting it be released as a feature film.
The war on drugs had become part of our popular culture in television programs like Cops.
When you cut on your local news at night, you see black men being paraded across the screen in handcuffs.
Black people, black men and black people in general, are overrepresented in news as criminals. When I say overrepresented, that means they are shown as criminals more times than is accurate that they are actually criminals, right? Based on FBI statistics.
I mean, I'm a big believer in the power of media full of these cliches that basically present mostly black and brown folks who seem like animals in cages. And then someone could turn off the TV thinking, it's a good thing for prisons, because otherwise those crazy people would be walking on my block.
Creating a context where people are afraid. And when you make people afraid, you can always justify putting people in a garbage can.
Chances are you could run into a kid waiting to relieve you of your purse or wallet.
Every media outlet.
It was a real privilege that they would reach out to me, of all people, just a little guy from Michigan, to offer a voice to this, as you say, with so many luminaries in it. To be honest with you, it's a real privilege that I've been able to, since I left Michigan as the Speaker of the House more than a decade ago, to be put into a situation where I could use my experience in overcoming my own addiction, going through the criminal justice system myself, for the benefit of other people. That really is something that I'm in awe of and very grateful for every day. And I think that's why I get invited to these things, is because we're all in this together as Americans. It's affecting all of our lives. It used to be, I think when Richard Nixon started this, it was more of an us and them type rhetoric when it came to criminal justice and those people that are out there on the streets. But what we've seen, particularly as it's metastasized, the failings of our criminal justice system, is that everybody knows somebody who's had struggles with addiction. Everybody knows somebody who has a criminal record that has repaid their debt to society, that is having difficulty providing for their family, to stay involved in the family unit, to be an economic contributor to their kids and to our country. And so these are very big problems. And what I said about the crime bill of 1994, and what I meant entirely, was that changed our relationship at the local level with police, because it was the federal government investing in the police to behave like a federal system, you know, with tanks and SWAT units and helicopters and all of these other things. So it kind of fundamentally changed our relationship with the police from a restorative, corrective, you know, familial. We want this kid or this young person or this husband and wife that are going through a messy situation in their life. Sure, we want to hold them accountable, but we want them to pay it back. We want them to be successful, to more of a top-down, we've got to get these people off the streets and punish our way out of this, and we're going to fund it with federal tax dollars. So it was a huge, I believe, structural change and also a massive error in public policy, the crime bill of 1994.
And do you agree that the war on drugs led to the rise in mass incarceration?
I believe that the war on drugs fueled a huge percentage of that. I believe that we can't stop there, though, when you say which policies need to change of who are locking up and for why. I believe that is by far and away the biggest contributor by percentage, runaway biggest contributor. But at Prison Fellowship, we don't equivocate and say, well, we're going to live up to our values as Americans or as Christians or as conservatives or liberals, whatever you want to say, where your values are rooted for people that commit nonviolent crimes with marijuana. But we still can throw away the life and the worth of a human being that, say, stole a stereo from Radio Shack. We don't believe that that's true. What we need to do is we need to change this system for everyone, because we have seen justice, a punishment that restores, that has a restorative value to it, a corrective value that can heal the community. And every time we throw away someone's life and every time we come short of our own values, who we hurt is ourselves in the community. The reforms that we advocate actually reduce crime and restore families and allow people to live to their God-given potential And we believe that should be available to everyone, regardless of their crime. But it's a great place to start. And as somebody who's in recovery for addiction myself, I know firsthand that the alcohol wasn't my problem. It was my solution to my problems. And until we wake up to that in America, the backward thinking that the availability of drugs is the reason why people choose to use them, then we're never going to make a dent in people's drug use in America.
I'm Brooke Allen for Current State, speaking with Craig DeRoche, the Senior Vice President of Advocacy and Public Policy for Prison Fellowship, about his appearance in 13th. Of course, this documentary was released before the election, and now that the election is over and it went opposite of what everyone expected, how do you think everything is going to turn out now that President-elect is Trump?
Well, I think everybody's got a lot of questions. I think that because of the fact that people did not expect Donald Trump to win the presidency, they didn't ask him questions. They shot right past it. You know, I think that Secretary Clinton was asked questions because of her husband's 1994 crime bill and because of statements that she made, which were covered in the film, like young African-American men being super predators and things that she said in the 1990s. I think that Ava DuVernay did an excellent job of being kind of fair and balanced, that everyone on the ballot has a reason for us to question their record.
I began to hear the word super predator as if that was my name.
Super predator. Predator.
Super predator.
Super predators, end quote. That's the word they use to describe this generation. And it was very, very effective.
Experts call them super predators.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy.
And with Donald Trump's poor behavior toward people at his rally and things that were represented there in the film, it would leave us with questions for either that got elected. But with Donald Trump in particular, getting away with saying something like law and order and safety is kind of a loaded political talking point.
In the Central Park Jagger case, they put 5 innocent teens in prison because the public pressure to lock up these quote-unquote animals was so strong.
You better believe that I hate the people that took this girl and raped her brutally. You better believe it.
Donald Trump wanted to give these kids a death penalty, and he took out a full-page ad to put the pressure on.
So we're gonna have to see if President Trump is going to actually follow the facts, which would lead to less incarceration in America, would lead to a greater sensitivity of what's happening with the policing and the prosecutions in our urban areas for economically disadvantaged people, primarily folks of color, and lead to changes there, or if he would revert to what we've done for 40 years that didn't work. But it sounded good on television. It's a good political template, but the evidence shows that didn't make us safer. It was more expensive, less efficient. It discarded human life, and it didn't actually make our streets safer. So we all have a lot of work to do. Folks like Prison Fellowship have a lot of work to do to make sure that President Trump and the leaders that he appoints in the key spots is aware of the opportunity that he has to continue the reforms that have worked in the states and expand them in the federal government.
One last question for you. If you had one thing to say to somebody who was out there and who had not seen 13th, what would you tell them?
It's a great story. And what makes it brilliant is it tells a story of America. I think more of the story needs to be told of the human experience to going through it. So I do hope that Ava DuVernay and others and that Netflix continues to produce movies along these lines and brings the Americans back into the conversation of criminal justice in their community.
Craig DeRoche, the Senior Vice President of Advocacy and Public Policy for Prison Fellowship, about his appearance in 13th.
Here come the drums!
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been great to be with you.
And coming up on Current State, imagine driving 50 or 75, imagine driving 100 miles for dental care. That's the situation that once faced a small town in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. It's closer to normal now, in part thanks to a Grand Ledge dentist who drives to Engadine to help patients. We'll learn more from that dentist, Dr. Richard Martzke, in just a few minutes on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. If you go to the Dollar General store on South Martin Luther King Boulevard in Lansing, you're likely to get more than just the items you purchase. You might get a song, too. Cashier Luke Holliday loves to break into song while he works, and one of his customers recently captured him doing that and posted it to YouTube. The video went viral, and the attention led to some unexpected results. Joining us in the studio is the famous singing cashier himself, Luke Holliday.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Martin? How you doing today?
Welcome to Current State.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
We're talking about over a million combined views in social media.
At least. There might be more, but I don't want to, you know, say the wrong thing there. But yeah, it's crazy to get noticed at this level. I think the main reason for that is there's an artist. It was a hip hop artist from Louisiana. His name is Lil Boosie, and Lil Boosie posted this video not long after the actual original video got. I think it might be like 630,000 something like that views, and it was posted by my regular customer Cherie Robinson, who. You know, me and her have been kind of going through this journey and figuring things out now. I'm getting offers, you know, so.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Tell us about the offers.
Well, I've heard from several different, record companies and management teams, trying to figure out whether or not, how interested I am in trying to, you know, create a solo career of some kind. At the same time, you know, I'm also working with my band. I have a band, Tell Yo Mama is what we're called. We're a funk blues band. And we, we've been working for a couple of years. We definitely want to continue that. So, you know, I'm kind of negotiating how to compromise and make, you know, work on my own as well as with my, you know,
right.
my people, the people that, you know, I got a lot of loyalty to them, a lot of love for them. So
you're at an interesting crossroads would seem. Let's hear a clip of the video we're talking about.
Realize. That you're the highest of the high. And if you don't know, then I'll say so don't ever wonder. 42, 34. So tell me how long it's gonna take until you speak, baby. Cause I can't live my life.
Lucas, you've got some chops. Well done. That's a great moment when you stop singing for a second and tell the customer the total and then just break back into the song again.
Yes, sir.
How often do you sing in a typical, you work an 8-hour shift, let's say?
Say regularly 5 to 6, usually, sometimes a little more, but that's how they split up everything, at least at my store.
So over a typical 5 or 6 hour shift, how often are you apt to bust into song?
Well, before people came in and started asking me to, you know, do it almost every time, I would do probably about at least twice a day, maybe 3 times a day. I'd either be humming to myself, kind of just going about my day, going about my business, just kind of getting ready to, you know, like continue on with the entire shift and so forth. It helps me work. It just helps me work to kind of hum through and sing through stuff. And then sometimes people will hear it, then they request to, you know, hear me at full voice, so forth. A lot of times I get some stops and some stares, you know. Not every time, though. I mean, I'm not always perfect now. Sometimes I'll get that was really nice, you know, and that's enough for me. As long as people are pleased somehow, you know.
Does your boss mind?
Well, I've said before that, especially recently with, you know, people calling me and stuff, that's definitely been, she's had to, you know, take time out to run the register. Well, she's allowed me to, because she's a very gracious person. But before that, I mean, it's really just, you know, yep, that's our Lucas. Yeah, he can sing. That's for sure. Mm. Hopefully he'll do something with it soon, you know.
Did you know the customer who recorded you?
Not closely, but at least not personally. I'd seen her several times in the store, and then she'd heard me before, maybe once, like a month, maybe a month and a half before this all occurred.
Okay.
And, I've known her family, members of her family for a while, and went to school with some of them and so forth. I went to Everett High School, so.
What was it like knowing that the internet was going nuts for this thing?
Insane. Like, when it happened, well, it was on election day, so when it happened, I had voted, and, you know, I don't mind to say that I was, a little bit displeased with the results. And in any case, but I don't need to get into that any more than it, you know, has to be. But I was at my other job, I was at my second job, which is a car part assembly factory, which, you know, at this point I've been kind of having to take time off of that. But I was working there, and I was trying to, just get through that day after realizing what was going on. And then I saw the internet. My phone was dead. Checked the internet, and I saw, 80,000, 90,000 views of this video. Yeah. And I'm like, something's going on here.
We're talking with Luke Holliday, Lansing singing cashier. A YouTube video of Luke doing his thing at Dollar General has gone viral, and as a result, he will join Maxwell on stage tomorrow night at the Palace of Auburn Hills.
That's right.
So how did Maxwell learn about the... Maxwell was online, and eventually the sensation you created reached him. It's his song you're singing in the video.
Yes, sir.
Clarify.
Yes, sir. The song is called Ascension, or Don't Ever Wonder is kind of an alternate name of it. I believe somebody's either sent it through. It happened on Twitter, though, that he mentioned, like, hey, if you guys know where this guy is, we'll fly him out to Detroit and so forth, which I'm just, I'm going to drive now that that's been set up. But yeah, he just literally said, if you could find this guy, let's see what can happen. I think it was the Shade Room on Instagram, actually. I'm sorry. It was, it popped up, and he said, oh, wow, he kills it. He commented on, with his Instagram account.
What did you think when you saw that?
It's the first moment I saw that. I thought maybe it was just going to be, it was kind of a, I don't know, it's unreal. It was almost as if, I'm like, all right, well, is this kind of a prompted thing? Is this an official page? Like, is this real?
Oh,
is this...
okay. Yeah.
So I'm kind of like, it was a little bit unreal to me, and I was skeptical, to be honest.
And you hooked up with Maxwell on Good Morning America a couple of days ago,
man.
And that's really what led to the offer to join him in Detroit?
That's true. Yeah, that was the official offer. I'd heard rumors and so forth, but once again, kind of skeptical, and then all of a sudden... boom, he asked me, and I'm elated and, praying to God.
You're going to do one song with Maxwell, or how is this going to work?
I don't have all the details yet. I don't want to, say anything out of character, out of proportion, I guess you could say. But I believe it's just going to be one song. I guess we'll see what happens, but, I'm not sure exactly, but we'll find out.
We'll just have to find out.
I know his pretty much his whole repertory, so I could probably pull out something if
no kidding.
Hopefully we'll try.
And Tell Your Mama has released a new album, correct?
Yes, sir. It's called Good Thing, with an A, Good Thing, Thang.
Thang.
yes. And, we literally just released this last Saturday, so. We played at the Avenue Cafe and off East Michigan Avenue.
Well done.
Yes, sir.
Well
yes,
done.
Sir.
Well, everybody's excited for you. Before you go, would you sing a little bit for us? Could you do that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's see. Well, I can actually do, I'll do another Maxwell, actually. Pray God you can cope. I'll stand outside this woman's work, this woman's world. And ooh, it's hard on a man. Now his part is over. Now starts the craft of the Father. I know you've got a little life in you yet, and I know you've got a lot of strength left, and I know you've got a little life in you yet, and I know you've got a lot of strength left.
Well done. done. Yes, well sir, done. Yes, Luke Holliday, Lansing singing cashier. A YouTube video of Luke doing his thing at Dollar General's gone viral, and as a result, he joins Maxwell on stage tomorrow night at the Palace of Auburn Hills.
Thank you, Mr.
Have
Martin.
Fun.
Yes, sir.
Be
yes,
in
sir.
The moment and enjoy it. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Coming up on Current State, English Shakespearean director Iqbal Khan is in town this week talking about the Bard with students and faculty at Michigan State University. We talk with him about that and about one of his earliest Shakespearean roles.
Yes, absolutely. I gave my Lady Macbeth at the age of 8. My accent was a little bit different then. It was more like tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
That's coming up later this hour on Current State. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Mark Bayshore. A Lansing area dentist is doing a little bridge work. On the other side of the bridge, Dr. Richard Martsky has run his own dental practice in Grand Ledge for more than 40 years. About 5 years ago, he began providing services a couple of days a month at a clinic in the tiny town of Engadine, about 50 miles northwest of St. Ignace. In 2014, the clinic shut down, forcing patients to travel great distances to seek dental care. But now the people of Engadine are smiling wide once again. The clinic is back, and its dentist has just returned from his first working weekend up north in nearly 2 years. Dr. Rich Martsky joins me now in the studio to talk about his work in the UP. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us by phone, Michelle Chapman. Michelle's the office manager for My Community Dental Centers in Sheboygan, the company which runs the Engadine Clinic. Michelle, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Dr. Martsky, you've been a practicing dentist in Grand Ledge more than 40 years. Just help us understand how you came to care for patients in this little town in the UP.
We have a second home in the UP about 13 miles from Engadine, along US 2. And we were up there just about the time we were at about 5 years ago. And we were just took a drive into Engadine. And I noticed that there was a dental clinic there. And so I told my wife, I says, I'm going to go in and say hi and just to introduce myself. And I went in and talked to the person at the reception desk. And I said to him, I says, you know, if you ever needed some extra help up here, you know, if I get towards the point that I retire or if we're up here on a weekend, you know, is that something you would need? And he said, I think this is, you walked in the right day.
So, how interesting.
The next thing I know, I was going to an interview up in Marquette a week later, and they said they would hire me. About 6 months later, I started working up there.
So. How interesting. Was it difficult for you to work out the logistics here? This is a long drive.
Well, we have our home there. So they were very cooperative in that. I said I could work maybe a Friday and a Saturday, which was something new, but they worked it out, and I would go up very early on Friday morning.
I imagine.
5 o'clock in the morning we'd leave, my wife and I, and I'd work 11 to 7, and then I'd work Saturday, like 8:30 to 5 or something, and it worked out.
You worked a couple of days a month in Engadine for about 3 years, and then the facility closed in 2014. How many patients were you serving by then, and what happened to them once they no longer had that resource of dental care?
Well, I think a lot of them just quit going to the dentist. And some probably found some other places to go. But a lot of them just were going without care.
Michelle Chapman, let's bring you in here. How did your organization, how did My Community Dental Centers get involved?
My Community Dental Centers has been exploring that area for some time, looking for areas that would work out for the need that's in there. They had opened a few centers over in Ewing and Spalding that I think were related to the same company that closed, and had spoke with the lady that run the center in Engadine and realized that would be a great opportunity to enter that area.
So the clinic in Engadine was just sitting idle for close to 2 years. What brought about the funding that finally helped it to reopen? What was your sales pitch here?
Delta Dental Foundation gave us a big grant to get some new equipment that was very needed in that area. And my community dental centers is operating the center, so they brought in the technology and the staffing and HR capabilities to get it back up and running.
We're talking with Michelle Chapman. She's the office manager with My Community Dental Centers in Sheboygan, the company that now runs the clinic where Dr. Richard Martsky of Grand Ledge practices. He's a dentist in private practice in Grand Ledge. He's the sole dental care provider at the Engadine Dental Center in the small town of Engadine up in the UP. Dr. Martsky, you just reopened the clinic on September the 9th. This past weekend, in fact, you made your first trip up north in almost 2 years. What was it like to reconnect with your patients and colleagues up there?
Well, it was rewarding. When we worked there before, we had a hygienist that drove from Escanaba. We had a...
How far is that?
It's about 100 miles
from
there.
Wow.
And the closest employee came from Curtis. It's probably 20 miles. Mm. And we had all worked together. We'd gotten along well. And when we heard that the clinic might be opening again, we all agreed to come back because we really enjoyed working together and taking care of the people. The real person that deserves a lot of credit is a lady named Ann Salzider, who helped found West Mackinac Health Association back in 1987. And she was a nurse at in Newberry. And after she retired, she's continued to head up this association, and the association owns the building and the equipment. And it was her dream to get this dental clinic back up and going. They have a medical clinic right next as part of the same building. And so she was the one that really pushed this, and she deserves a lot of credit to helping keep this facility and going in the village and to help the people in the area.
How long do you think you're signed on for making this trip to Engadine?
I don't know. As long as I enjoy it, and we do have a home just 13 miles from the clinic, so I can see myself doing this for a while. So as long as I enjoy it, and I think we're doing a lot of good for people and helping people. The people are very appreciative of what you do for them.
I'd like both of you to comment here on your patients. Dr. Martsky commented a minute ago, Michelle, that he fears that a lot of these people just went without dental care here for after the clinic shut down completely in 2014. What's the economic situation? Does that suggest that a lot of people don't have dental insurance, I guess?
Well, there are over 5,000 people that are enrolled in Medicaid itself in Duluth, Alger, Mackinac, and Schoolcraft counties, and another 2,000 that have the Healthy Michigan plan. So there's, a good amount of people that have dental coverage with nowhere within 100 miles to go. We found that a lot of the people with great need, urgent need, did come to see us down in Sheboygan. We would have been the closest. And so, when it got to the point where they really had to go, they came to see us. But they weren't going anywhere for, preventative care. It was once they were in pain and really needed treatment.
Are there any plans to hire at least one dentist who lives closer to your patients?
They're exploring opportunities either to expand the Engadine Center or in the area to be open more frequently. But at this time, I'm not sure, exactly whether it's to expand the Engadine one or to add more in the area.
Dr. Martsky, I understand the clinic is getting some technology upgrades. Can you tell us about those?
Yes, we now have digital radiography, which is really works in that setting there because we can communicate between clinics if we have to send somebody to another clinic for more advanced services, oral surgery or endodontics. And there's still some need for a few more things. But, you know, I think that will come in time as we are able to get the clinic going more.
Do you ever find yourself in the car after a long work week in Grand Ledge thinking, what am I doing driving to Engadine?
Oh, yes. once I get, you know, my mother was born in the UP, so
why you've got the place up north is because of roots in the Upper Peninsula.
Yes, it is. You know, okay. I've always enjoyed the UP, and I'm really fortunate because my wife enjoys it also. And so when we get up to our home up there, it's on a small river in the woods, and it's very peaceful. So it's just a great place to go.
Nice retirement gig. Someday.
It is. Yes.
Someday. Even the center is such a peaceful place, and the people are so nice in the area.
I'd like to ask both of you briefly here. We've got just under a minute. Has this situation shaped your thoughts on healthcare policy or in insurance or such matters? Michelle?
One thing I've realized being in the dental field is the gap for Medicare patients. They always talk about it being with prescriptions, but really it's highly in the dental area is a big gap for coverage.
You agree with that, Dr. Martsky, or what do you think?
Yes, we get people actually come to the clinic that have private care insurance, and some people will pay their own way. And it's very difficult for dentists in private practice to work under the Medicaid model just because the reimbursement is so low.
Do you think that could change?
I think there's not a shortage of dentists. That's contrary to some belief. I think if that reimbursement was raised, more dentists would do that. I've always done the Healthy Kids program in my practice, which a lot of other dentists do, just to help children. But I think if that reimbursement was changed, you would see more utilization.
Mm. We've been talking about the reopening of a dental clinic in a small Upper Peninsula town and the Grand Ledge dentist who's resuming monthly trips up north to serve his patients there. We want to thank Dr. Richard Martsky and Michelle Chapman with My Community Dental Centers in Sheboygan. Thanks to both of you for your time today. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All this week, MSU's College of Arts and Letters Leading Voices series has been underway with theatrical director Iqbal Khan in residency here in East Lansing. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with the Englishman, born of Pakistani immigrants, about his take on directing works by Shakespeare at London's Globe Theatre and another very well-known organization.
Most recently, I've done quite a lot of work with the Royal Shakespeare Company, which is the home of Shakespeare in the world, Stratford-upon-Avon. It's where he was born. I've directed two seminal productions there, most recently Othello at the Odyssey. And I will be directing Antony and Cleopatra, starting rehearsals in 3 weeks' time. and this last year, I've just completed a production of Macbeth at the Globe Theatre in London, which is a theatre that was built on the lines of the original Globe Theatre where Shakespeare's company would have performed.
For this week-long kind of seminar or residency that you've had at Michigan State University, I know a lot of the students have been directed to watch the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company, rendition of Othello. Why do you think that was such a touchstone for them and a good starting point into knowing about you?
The reason why I think it's particularly insightful, though, is that what's going on in the production is a sort of a slight revision, a slight sort of a radical rethinking of the play in the context of the sort of, you know, the modern context. The world we live in now has much more complicated views about race, for instance, about questions of to do with the other in the world. I hope my production dealt with that in a more nuanced way than it is often done with that play.
Particularly as playing foil to Hugh Quarshie's Othello was.
Lucy Masmati, who played a black man, a Zimbabwean originally, who played Iago. And obviously that caught all the headlines because Iago is normally seen as the proto-fascist, the white fascist. It seemed a whimsical decision on my part to cast a black man just because I could in that part. But actually, I did have very, very serious reasons why I thought that was an appropriate thing to do. When I read the play again, the thing that strikes me about the play is Iago incites racial hatred in others. His own position on it is much more complex and much more elusive. And so in casting a black man, I wanted to problematize his own views about that sort of thing. I mean, there exists racism within the black community, within the Asian community, against other blacks. The different kinds of black experience are criticized within the community, so we could explore that. But we could also explore the way Iago exploits a kind of vulnerability about the vocabulary of race in the dominant white community. If you're given permission to use dangerous words, racial slurs by a black man, the white man might enjoy that. If in the middle of the laugh, the black man ceases to laugh, that would make you very, very uncomfortable. So there is a kind of a power that the man of color can potentially have in that engagement, which speaks, I think, to a kind of a trauma about the vocabulary of race that exists in the world at the moment.
I'm assuming some of that came up during the main part of your presentation, which was Tuesday evening at MSU.
Yeah, exactly. I talked about it towards the end. And then there were some very interesting questions, and one in particular where somebody in the audience asked me whether in casting a black Iago, had I not opened the door to white directors and producers asking for the same kind of allowances for white actors to play Othello again. And as far as I'm concerned, I think that's fantastic. If they want to do it, if they're qualified to do it, if there's an articulate version of the play, I don't see why they shouldn't. I'm against exclusion of any kind. It's not about breaking the door down for people of color. It's about opening all doors and allowing all people to do, to have the opportunities that they can have. I didn't make it as clear as I should have done on Tuesday, but let me make it absolutely clear now that for the first 10 years of my life as a theater practitioner, I hardly worked at all with a person of color. And I resisted being read as an Asian theater artist. I wanted to be read as a theater artist. And I didn't do many kind of racial subversions of plays. I just did the plays. I have been associated with these kinds of experiments more recently, but actually I would do it the other way around as well. It's not that I want to become associated with sort of racial experiments with plays all the time. It's absolutely not the case. The play's the thing, as far as I'm concerned. The great thing about theatre is that it's not realistic. Is that any person can stand on stage with another person, and so long as they declare their relationship clearly, and if we believe that declaration, then we're off. Then they can play mother and son, whether it's a black mother and a white son, etc. You know, it appeals to our imagination much more than the realist frame of the television or the cinema, and that's incredibly liberating. I mean, in Shakespeare's time, Elizabethan theatre, all the women were played by men. You know, we have permission to play in that way.
We're speaking with Iqbal Khan, the English theater director who is currently in a week-long residency in East Lansing with the MSU College of Arts and Letters Leading Voices series. And Iqbal, How did this relationship come about with you coming to Michigan?
Professor Joyce Singh, who's a lecturer and part of the faculty at MSU, was in the UK in 2012. She's often there working there with your summer program. And I was doing a production of Much Ado About Nothing. And so we met, and I was setting the production in modern Delhi, New Delhi. And so I met with her. We talked about the play. She contributed something to the program. And we developed a friendship then. And then subsequently, she's come back to the UK and I've met her. I when I was doing my Othello in 2015 at the RSC, she brought a bunch of students with her for the summer program there. And I came and I gave a lecture to them, talked to them about the production. I think she says that my version of the Amelia Desdemona scene at the end was the first version of that scene that she'd ever seen, that where she felt it told the story most honestly, most interestingly. And on the basis of that scene alone, she was desperate that I come here and spend some time with the students here, etc. So yeah, and we've kept up that relationship, and she initiated that contact, and I've met the rest of the faculty, and Professor Kirk Dormer has been incredibly important in setting this up. The dean, Chris Long, it accords with his vision for the resources he wants to make available to his students. I think it's an incredibly enlightened time at MSU, and I've only been here a couple of days. I feel like I've been here 2 weeks already. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in a glorious way. I feel like it's a sort of place you feel like you're stepping out of the world and given time to think, given time to reflect. And it's an extraordinary privilege to be here.
I understand. And tell me how this came about. There is tape of you as Lady Macbeth.
There is tape of me as Lady Macbeth. When I was very young, my brothers and I would record all the great works of dramatic literature. So Shakespeare obviously was one of those things. And yes, absolutely. I gave my Lady Macbeth at the age of 8. I was born in Birmingham, so my accent was a little bit different then. It was more like tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. So yeah, no, it was. The thing is, what was lovely about that for us as children, what was that we weren't afraid. We just did what we wanted to do with it. And I loved opera when I was 6, 7, 8. I didn't see it as something that I wasn't entitled to, or I shouldn't. Or wasn't available to me. Would sing along with Cheryl Milnes and Pavarotti, etc., all of them. And all of that seemed fine. It all was available to us. Bob Dylan was available to us. Pink Floyd were available to us. Johnny Cash, it was all there, available to us, what it is to be human and the finest things that humans have done. High and low art, but there was no distinction between that in our thinking when we were younger. And I still carry that in me at present, and in all the work that I do, and all the interactions that I have with young people, as well as in the rehearsal room, there is no hierarchy of taste. It's execution, really. That is the thing.
Iqbal Khan is an English director for the Royal Shakespeare Company, has also directed for the Globe Theatre in London, and is in residency in East Lansing this week as part of the MSU College of Arts and Letters Leading Voices series. Iqbal, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
For an extended version of this interview, including Mr. Khan speaking about uncovering the truths in Shakespeare.
I think the braver you are with it, the more Shakespearean you are with it. The more you flatten it out, the politer you are with it, I think the further away you get from the plays.
You can head to the arts and culture section of WKAR.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, Live Music Friday. The city of Lansing prides itself on its manufacturing roots, but officials say, like many communities, Lansing is subject to unfair trade agreements and job outsourcing that hurts local workers. Mayor Virge Bernero is co-chairing an initiative to create a national plan to boost job growth in advanced manufacturing. We'll talk with Mayor Bernero from a conference he's attending about this in Pittsburgh. And it's time for one of Lansing's greatest traditions. Tomorrow is Silver Bells, the 32nd annual celebration. We'll learn about this year's lineup of activities from Mindy Bildadue, Executive Director of Downtown Lansing, Inc. Hope you can join us then. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. You can stay connected with Current State on Twitter, at KAR Current State. Check out our Facebook page, too, Current State from WKAR. Have a great day. We'll see you Friday on Current State.